Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, a journey into mystery and a gateway to the mind of nature and the nature of mind. This is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, happy to be here with you so that together we can create a culture of wisdom, love, and beauty. Auspicious interbeing to you and yours, my friends, Koinos Hermes, a deep bow of gratitude and reverence to Sophia. This is a big contemplation. The way of the wolf. We're going to go deep, so stick with it. The terrain could get a little rocky. Now, last time we reflected a little further into ecological thinking and tried to better understand something that might at first seem merely poetic. Thinking like a mountain. That has to have a big meaning for us, because this kind of thinking can bring real medicine to the world. And I come to you today in the shadow of all the wounds of the world, including the wars in Europe and the Middle East, the terrible crises on the African continent, and the continuing ecological crises that go all together with the humanitarian crises. For all the intense emotions that these terrible things can evoke in us, I know that some of us also feel an additional emotional charge in relation to our non-human kin. In particular, it has been pretty challenging to hear about what happened in Wyoming with a young female wolf. In this contemplation, we will return to a famous passage from Aldo Leopold that invites us to see wolves differently. We considered it before, but now we will consider it with a beginner's mind and put it in a different context to give it a fresh meaning. That context includes our last contemplation, so let's refresh our memory about it a little bit. You can jump in here. You might want to listen to the last one on the myth of freedom. But if you want to just get to the wolves, I understand where you're coming from. Just a little context, though. We considered the idea that we need a better sense of the meaning of thinking. We don't know how to think well. If we did, we'd have peace. And not only would we have peace, but we'd have clean water to drink, clean air to breathe, plenty of food for everyone. We wouldn't be in the midst of a self-created extinction event. And we wouldn't see so much inequality and injustice. What's our problem? Gregory Bateson put it plainly when he said our problem is that human beings don't know how to think the way nature works. How can we arrive at more vitalizing ways of thinking? How can we learn to think the way nature works? Put another way, how can we think more creatively and more in accord with wisdom, love, and beauty? We noted that Bateson gives us a hard-nosed scientific argument that indicates mountains think, and that we might somehow need to learn to think more like mountains. We associated that kind of thinking with wildness itself. Bad thinking amounts to domesticated thinking. We need to go further into all of this, but we can at least say better thinking doesn't require us to live naked in the woods. However, it does require more contact with nature beyond the built environment that most of us get. Most of us get confined to. And it requires us to learn to think from the wild beings who made us what we are. We're not just going to learn this in books. It's not that books have nothing to teach us. But it's very much like what the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss said. He said that indigenous peoples don't revere animals because they're good to eat. Rather, they revere them because they are good to think. We need to learn how to think wolf, just as we need to learn how to think horse. Just like we can follow the way of the horse, we can follow the way of the wolf in order to begin to think the way nature works. In the book The Philosopher and the Wolf, the philosopher Mark Rowlands writes about his profound relationship with a wolf who came to live with him as a puppy. We'll get to the puppy in a moment. First, let's start with what Rowlands does in this book, which is a wonderful work of philosophy. I recommend it wholeheartedly. And those of you who listen regularly, or those of you who know me or have worked with me, I don't recommend too many books by living philosophers. But this one is worth reading. Let's start with a slightly longer passage. I'll let you know when we get to the end, but it's important framing for everything we're going to consider. Here's what Rowlands writes. If I wanted a one-sentence definition of human beings, this would do. Humans are the animals that believe the stories they tell about themselves. Humans are credulous animals. In these dark times, it does not need emphasizing that the stories we tell about ourselves can be the biggest source of division between one human and another. From credulity, there is often but a short step to hostility. However, I am concerned with the stories we tell to distinguish ourselves, not from each other, but from other animals. The stories we tell about what makes us human. Each story has what we might call a dark side. It casts a shadow. That shadow is to be found behind what the story says. Here you will find what the story shows, and this is likely to be dark in at least two ways. First of all, what the story shows is often a deeply unflattering, even disturbing, facet of human nature. Second, what the story shows is often difficult to see. The two senses are not unconnected. We humans have a pronounced facility for passing over the aspects of ourselves we find distasteful, and this extends to the stories we tell to explain ourselves to ourselves. The wolf is, of course, the traditional, if unfairly selected, representative of the dark side of humanity. This is in many ways ironic, not least etymologically. The Greek word for wolf is leukos, which is so close to the word for light, leukos, that the two were often associated. It may be that this association was simply the result of mistakes in translation, or it may be that there was a deeper etymological connection between the two words. But for whatever reason, Apollo was regarded as both the god of the sun and the god of wolves. And in this book, it is the connection between the wolf and the light that is important. Think of the wolf as the clearing in the forest. In the bowels of the forest, it may be too dark to see the trees. The clearing is the place that allows what was hidden to be uncovered. The wolf, I shall try to show, is the clearing in the human soul. The wolf uncovers what is hidden in the stories we tell about ourselves, what those stories show but do not say. We stand in the shadow of the wolf. Something can cast a shadow in two ways, by occluding light, or by being the source of light that other things occlude. We talk of the shadows cast by a man and those cast by a fire. By the shadow of the wolf, I mean not the shadow cast by the wolf itself, but the shadows we cast from the light of the wolf. And staring back at us from these shadows is precisely what we don't want to know about ourselves. That's the passage, and it's powerful stuff. The whole book is powerful stuff. It examines a lot of wonderful philosophical ideas about the nature of human beings and the nature of the world we live in. Wolves are a spiritual keystone species, and it behooves us to cultivate reverence for them. Much of what we considered in the episode called Horse Magic, Horse Medicine, Horse Mystery applies to wolves. A spiritual keystone species can shine a lot of light into our shadows and help us to evolve. Roland's named the wolf that came to live with him Brennan, and here's what he wrote about their relationship. It is the concept of guardianship rather than ownership that seems to provide the most plausible way of understanding the primary relationship between people, at least decent people, and their companion animals. But with Brennan, this doesn't quite seem to fit either. This is what distinguished him decisively from any dog I have ever known. It was only at some times and in some circumstances that Brennan was my younger brother. At other times and in other circumstances, he was my older brother. A brother that I admired and wanted above all to emulate. As we shall see, this was no easy task, and I never achieved more than a fraction of it. But it was the attempt and the resulting struggle that forged me. The person I became, I am utterly convinced, is better than the one I would otherwise have been. And nothing more can be asked of an older brother. Now, I think many of us have had the sense that our dogs can make us better people. But I have to agree with Roland's that domestication has affected most of our dogs in many of the same ways it has affected us and most horses, though many horses, even domesticated ones, seem to have a closer connection to wildness than most humans and probably also most dogs. We can learn something from our wild kin that we can't necessarily learn so well from our domesticated kin. In some sense, our wild kin made us what we are. We've talked about that before, and we have simply forgotten all about their influence. That includes horses, when most horses were wild, and it includes wolves. To appreciate the brilliance of wild thinking, especially as it's embodied by wolves, let's consider the example of the most famous wolf of our era. Wolf 21 of Yellowstone Park here on Turtle Island, a.k.a. North America. The last wolves were killed in that area way back in 1926, but a group of humans campaigned for their return. And in 1995, wolves from Canada arrived as part of a special initiative. Rick McIntyre spent more hours outside watching wolves than any other human being I know of. He chronicles the reintroduction of the wolves in four marvelous books. Read them, and you will thank me. They will take you on an adventure into the wild and into the way of the wolf. The first book is called The Rise of Wolf 8. At the beginning of the book, McIntyre writes, quote, "This book will tell the story of two wolves, the greatest wolf who ever lived, and the one that was greater than him." Now, I think if you read that book and you read the series, you'll come to feel that he's right about that, that it's true. Now, he also writes something else. Quote, "The story told in this book is an epic one, filled with heroes and heroines who struggle to survive and defend their families. A story that includes all the elements of a great tale. Warfare, betrayal, murder, bravery, compassion, empathy, loyalty, and an unexpected hero. It is a story that deserves to be told by a literary genius such as Shakespeare, Homer, or Dickens. None of those writers was available." That's the quote. I have to say, Rick does a great job. He might not be Shakespeare, but the books are easy to read. They're good reading, and they'll get you hooked. The greatest wolf who ever lived was Wolf 8. Of course, there are many great wolves. Wolf 8 will win your heart, though, for his spirit and for his incredible courage, dignity, and kindness, which he taught to his adopted son, Wolf 21, who became an even greater wolf than Wolf 8. Wolf 21 was a superhero. Really, a bodhisattva, maybe even a Buddha. He never lost a fight, even though he once got jumped by 6 other wolves. He didn't lose. He also never killed any of his opponents. Instead, once he had clearly triumphed, he let them go. So he was not an alpha male, as we habitually think of that term. We have that term still around. We use it in this backward sense. Wolf 21 exuded the dignity, courage, and kindness his adoptive father taught him. You already see wolf culture. That's important. Nature is made by culture. Nature and culture, in fact, are not 2 things, and we see that in this wolf pack. And his education allowed him to think clearly and to focus on cultivating peace and well-being in his pack without aggression. He maintained peace rather than provoking violence. Only because of his fine character did his lineage survive. If he had killed all his rivals, he would not have become an ancestor wolf. His family line would have died out. But because of his kindness and clear thinking, his compassion and his courage, his lineage survived. However, he once faced a particularly terrible situation. Now, of course, he had to leave his pack when he grew up so that he could lead his own pack. That's part of the epic that you definitely want to hear, that story, being raised by Wolf 8 and then having to go off and find his own pack. And it involves a beautiful love story between Wolf 21 and the love of his life, Wolf 42. But when he first took leadership of that pack, the pack that Wolf 42 was part of, the alpha female was another wolf, Wolf 40. Now, she embodied the negative idea of an alpha personality. She was aggressive, reactive, violent, competitive. She was a bit of a psychopath. Wolf 21 put up with her because male wolves have to honor their female companions. There's a wolf culture that he had to live by. Still, his heart belonged to Wolf 42, and hers belonged to him. I love their love story. It's beautiful. Now, one fateful day, Wolf 8 found himself in Wolf 21's territory. And he had a job to do, which is protect his family. He threw himself into that job every day, even though at this point, 2 of his canine teeth had gone missing, and 1 had gotten broken. He couldn't possibly take down Wolf 21 even with a full set of teeth, let alone with only 1 functioning canine. Now, Rick McIntyre watched as the confrontation began to unfold. He felt a sense of wonder at the courage Wolf 8 showed, and he knew what it meant. because Wolf 21 had to protect his family too. Wolf 8 had wandered into his territory, and Wolf 21 had already lost several pups. He had only two living pups, and he had to protect them. As a skilled fighter, Wolf 21 would naturally single out the leader of the opposing pack and take him down. Given his character, he would let his opponent live. However, Wolf 40 was running hard behind him. Her hyper-aggressive personality would lead her to attack Wolf 8 while 21 had him pinned, and Wolf 8 would surely die. As the wolves got closer and closer, they were charging at each other. McIntyre tensed up. This was it. 21 would have to kill his adoptive father. There was no other choice. And then Wolf 21 did something incredibly creative and wild. He and Wolf 8 are running at full force right at each other, and he ran right past Wolf 8 without even touching him, let alone attacking him. It was impossible. It was like magic. Rick McIntyre didn't even know what he was seeing. He was shocked. All the wolves who were with Wolf 21 ran right along with him, straight through the opposing pack. And everything became disorganized and confused. It was as if no one really knew what happened or what they were supposed to do next. After several minutes, Wolf 8's pack gathered together and started to jump on each other with excitement. 21 ran to his pups and led them away. No one got hurt. You can understand why people cried when Wolf 21 finally died. They genuinely admired him. Just reading about him gave me so much admiration. The life of that wolf and the love story between Wolf 21 and Wolf 42, that will stay with me for as long as I live. If I end up with dementia someday, in the sea of confusion that dementia may bring, I bet that story of Wolf 21 will appear like floating timber that will buoy me up for moments of clarity and joy. Wolf 21 embodied exceptionally skillful thinking and incredible dignity and courage. Wolves in general have the capacity to do this. That's why the philosopher Mark Rowlands felt so much admiration for the wolf he lived with, the wolf who felt like an older brother. From a species perspective, wolves are our elders. That might be why humans, deeply under the sway of domestication, can show such incredible ignorance in relation to wolves. We're like a silly younger sibling. I say this with a heavy heart. In the midst of all the problems in our world, in the midst of all the gratuitous violence and suffering, some human beings try to make themselves feel better about themselves by killing and tormenting wolves, coyotes, and other sentient beings. Humans can utterly refuse to see the dignity of other sentient beings. In human conflicts, like human wars, we find a terrible effort to dehumanize the supposed enemy. This is not just wars, but even political conflict. It's this attempt to dehumanize the other side. And this reveals yet another layer of ignorance. If one group of humans tries to dehumanize another, it means they have already accepted the yoke of domestication themselves, and they have already asserted human privilege to feel better about themselves, you see? You have to think that dehumanizing is dehumanizing. You have to accept the premise in order for it to make you feel better about yourself. And it means we have cut ourselves off from what we are. Anytime we do that, we seek a common enemy to bolster a sense of connection and superiority. So it feeds itself. It's like a feedback loop, you see. We cut ourselves off from what we are. Now we feel terrible. Now we've got to find a common enemy to gang up on. And what do? Well, we dehumanize them because we've cut ourselves off from what we are. So the level of confusion here boggles the mind. I don't want to have to talk about what humans are doing right now to dehumanize each other. I don't want to have to talk about what one human being recently did to a wolf because he transgressed against his own dignity in the process. Just as we transgress against our own dignity any time we fail to acknowledge sentience and sacredness in this world we share. It's not easy to acknowledge sentience and sacredness. It brings a great responsibility to us, and sometimes it brings fear and trembling. When some people see a Mustang or a wolf, they can't get in touch with the natural sense of awe, reverence, and inspiration that belong to all of us. And that means they can't learn and can't transcend their own limitations. The wolf or the Mustang cannot function as an invitation and a guide into the great mystery. Instead, driven by ignorance, fear, grasping, aversion, and self-doubt, many human beings resort to domination and aggression, especially in relation to the wild. They then take up an attitude of exploitation toward the world in order to fill a hole they can never fill. They try to feed their hunger by eating shadows. And we keep that going by telling ourselves reassuring stories. In the episode on the myth of freedom and the way of mountain thinking, we considered how stories keep our insanity going and how a proper mythology might help us uncage ourselves. The same goes on in human wars and in the relationship between humans and wolves, humans and coyotes, humans and countless other beings. Remember what Rowlands wrote. He wrote, "I am concerned with the stories we tell to distinguish ourselves not from each other but from other animals, the stories we tell about what makes us human." We have ourselves locked in unskillful stories about what we are, what others are, what the world is, what the cosmos is. It keeps us stuck in gratuitous suffering, and it keeps us at war with ourselves, with each other, and with nature and all our kin. And that's part of what's going on in the Middle East and in Europe and in Africa. It just goes together. And that's the subtle thing that's in his quote there. When Roland says, "I'm concerned with the stories we tell to distinguish ourselves not from each other but from other animals," it's because both happen at the same time automatically. And we don't have to live like this. The wild ones still call to us. We can still find joy, wonder, inspiration, and genuine magic in the world. We're going to get to that too. The world still proclaims the sacred teachings of all our wisdom traditions. It's right there. We just have to listen to the wolves, to the mustangs, to the mountains, rivers, forests, and oceans. The wolves' presence, what the wisdom traditions try to teach us. They embody it. They live it. We need to focus on the beauty, the joy, the creativity, and wisdom we find directly in the wild and in the community of life. We also need to look at the hard thing. If we look only at the positive things, we will lose touch with compassion. But it takes an active practice of compassion to be able to look at our own ignorance and the terrible consequences of human ignorance we find in this world. Ignorance is our only enemy. The humans who torture and kill wolves are not our enemy. The humans who torture and kill other humans are not our enemy. Only ignorance is our enemy. If I were to call the man in Wyoming who tortured and killed a female yearling wolf a monster, I would presence the same basic energy that he did when he tortured and killed that female yearling wolf. The same holds for the ways both sides of a human conflict attempt to dehumanize one another and justify killing each other's children. We see an armed conflict in the Middle East that has resulted in the deaths of thousands and thousands of children. It's unconscionable. But we still have to see things clearly and not allow anyone to distract us from the fundamental point, including seeing how human conflict goes together with human centrism, and how our great sin of cutting ourselves off from the wildness and sacredness of life has driven us to degrade our world and create more suffering and the potential for ever greater conflicts. We suffer from a lack of spiritual and ecological thinking in total non-duality. Accepting all of this, accepting that ignorance is our only enemy, and looking clearly into the suffering in ourselves and our world, that requires a big practice. Now, we had several episodes on compassion training, and you can find free resources for compassion training on the Dangerous Wisdom website on the resources page. No strings, it's just free. And keep in mind that compassion offers us a clear path to authentic fierceness. Compassion can be fierce. The difference between fierce compassion and human aggression in part has to do with human agendas. A wolf like Wolf 21 defending his pups, he isn't angry. He's fierce. He does nothing more than he needs to do, and he doesn't kill the aggressors. And we saw the creativity that he used there. If he had been hooked by mere aggression, he would have attacked Wolf 8. His mind was bigger than that, bigger than the human watching, who thought for sure there's no other choice. That's it. That's the end of Wolf 8. So this capacity to presence fierceness without reactivity and aggression, Wolf 21 is our teacher. He is our elder. Most of us, unless you're already perfectly compassionate and creative and fierce, we turn to someone as a teacher in part out of a sincere reverence and admiration. The philosopher Mark Rowlands wrote about this reverence and admiration as follows. On our runs together, I realized something both humbling and profound. I was in the presence of a creature who was, in most important respects, unquestionably, demonstrably, irredeemably, and categorically superior to me. This was a watershed moment in my life. I'm a confident guy. If people don't think of me as arrogant, perhaps they do, that's only because I'm good at hiding it. I can't ever remember feeling this way in the presence of a human being. That's not me at all. But now, I realize that I wanted to be less like me and more like Brennan. That's a powerful passage. I know a lot of people who probably feel that way, that they have enough confidence that they've never really wanted to be somebody else, and they've never really felt that sense of awe at another human. And Rollins describes this as deeply aesthetic, a deeply aesthetic experience. Brennan had many virtues, but Rollins noticed the incredible grace in Brennan's manner of moving in the world, his whole way of using himself. And that's pretty charged if you've listened to some of our other contemplations. That's a big issue. That's a central philosophical issue. How do we use the self? And Brennan's way of using himself, his relationality, his dance with the world, with life, was just full of grace. And we'll give a description of that too. This one's a little longer. I'll let you know when we get to the end of it. Here's what Rollins writes. When we were running, Brennan would glide across the ground with an elegance and economy of movement. When Brennan trotted, his shoulders and back remained flat and level. From a distance, it looked as if he was floating an inch or two above the ground. I can still see it. The ghostly wolf in the early morning Alabama mist, gliding effortlessly over the ground, silent, fluid, and serene. The contrast with the noisy, puffing, and leaden-footed thudding of the ape that ran beside him could not have been more pronounced or depressing. I wanted to be able to lope. I wanted to glide across the ground as if I was floating an inch or two above it. But no matter how good at running I became, and I became very good, this was always going to escape me. Aristotle once distinguished the souls of plants from those of animals. Plants, he claimed, have merely a nutritive soul, a soul whose function is to take in, process, and excrete food. But the souls of animals, Aristotle called locomotive souls. It is no accident, I think, that he characterized the souls of animals in terms of movement. Contrary to what I was told as a student, I don't think Aristotle simply meant that animals move around whereas plants do not. He was not, in general, a fan of platitudes. Rather, I think if you want to understand the soul of the wolf, the essence of the wolf, what the wolf is all about, then you should look at the way the wolf moves. And the crabbed and graceless bustling of the ape, I came to realize with sadness and regret, is an expression of the crabbed and graceless soul that lies beneath. Okay, that's the end of the passage. Rollins calls all of this, quote, an unfortunate case of species envy, end quote. I think he's right. Human beings can suffer from species envy. Now, I also think there are some things about this passage I would challenge, because we have to look at the wisdom traditions and understand that this sort of grace that he's talking about is part of what marks the sage. There's a special grace in the whole way of using the self, the whole dance. It is a dance. It becomes a dance. Their ordinary activity becomes a dance. You see this in Zhuangzi and in other Taoists. You see this in the Buddhist traditions, the Buddhist streams. You see it again and again. But that doesn't take away from the spirit here. It's almost feels like nitpicking. At the same time, I just think it's important to recognize that context, It veers a little bit into a self-loathing. And this is, I think, what can happen. Human beings can get a species envy that gets so heavy. And I'm sure Rollins is, this is partly literary. He's taking some poetic license here. And this species envy is not just about aesthetics. It's aesthetics holistically considered, you know? It's not just that wolves are beautiful and graceful, but in that movement is courage, strength, and sheer wildness. So if we allow the aesthetic to encompass the whole of it, the beauty of their thinking, like Wolf 21, that was a beautiful moment when he ran past Wolf 8. There was just a beauty in it. You can see it in your mind. His relationship with his pups, his relationship with Wolf 42, the love of his life, is all of that is the movement of that wolf. Wolves presence wildness. And that doesn't mean they presence chaos or incoherence. It means they presence clarity, lucidity, intimacy, and holistic knowing that most humans have gotten totally cut off from. Wolves remind us of a dignity that belongs to us, a dignity and a grace that belong to us but which we have forsaken. They remind us of something indigenous to our own souls which we have covered over almost completely. And so they frighten us. They frighten us as a presence of the sacred. As we have said, the sacred is that which evokes fear and trembling in an untrained heart. The howl of a wolf, let alone the sight of one, can evoke that sense of the sacred that infuses the whole cosmos. We could let that sacredness teach us. As a spiritual keystone species of special quality, the wolf appears in the mandala of the Dangerous Wisdom curriculum. All of the people who learn the Dangerous Wisdom curriculum learn that mandala, and thus they enter into the lessons the wolf can teach. It's up to them how far they go, but it's always there. If we could put those lessons in a short phrase, it has to do with joyful perseverance and an incredible trust in self and world, an unshakable confidence, and an attitude that every situation is workable. Now, when human beings say words like those, the ones I just said, they usually amount to mere platitudes. But wolves embody it. They presence it. They teach us about real possibilities for this life. We recently had Carl Safina on the podcast, and I recommend that dialogue. I recommend the book we talked about, which is his most recent book about his relationship with a wild being, an owl in his case. That's another spiritual keystone species, another wild being. And I mentioned another of his books, his book Beyond Words. In that book, Safina writes about the wolves in Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming. Now, he doesn't just write about the wolves. I want to make that clear. He writes about elephants. He writes about cetaceans. It's a really good book. But one section of the book is devoted to the Yellowstone wolves. Now, here's what he writes. It's really interesting how he describes all this and experiences it. Safina writes, during the reintroduction operations, researchers worried that the wild caught Canadian wolves might try dashing straight back home to Canada. So for several weeks, they kept them in large acclimation pens. Most of them accepted this arrangement, but three defiant wolves never tolerated confinement. One jumped high enough to latch onto an overhanging section of 10-foot-high fence, then actually managed to curl his body around the overhanging mesh and escape. And then he dug back in from the outside, releasing his comrades. The three defiant wolves' relentless chewing on the chain-link fence caused extreme damage to their canine teeth, basically wearing them flat. Doug Smith, Yellowstone's lead wolf researcher, said to Safina, "I thought, wow, these guys are doomed." But after release, you could not tell there was anything at all wrong. I thought, how in the world is this wolf without canines killing elk? Wolf jaws exert 1,200 pounds of pressure per square inch, twice that of a German shepherd. That's crushing power. Four or five times, Doug Smith has caught a wolf to replace a collar and discovered that the animal had healed a broken leg. Since I put their first collar on, I'd been tracking them the whole time. There was never an indication that meanwhile they'd broken a leg. Once, Smith was in a helicopter over a running pack. They were doing the porpoising thing in deep snow, as if they were dolphins, going in and out of the snow like dolphins leaping in and out of the ocean. I darted the one at the back of the pack to put a collar on. When we reached it on the ground, I was shocked to see it had only three legs. From the air, I couldn't see anything wrong with how that wolf was running. In that same group with the three-legged wolf, another wolf got a broken shoulder in late winter, probably from a kick by an elk or bison. She was 10 years old, exceptional longevity for a free-living wolf, and she lasted all the next spring and summer. I think others might have been helping her, said Doug Smith. In autumn, she faded out. Smith says, when you examine their bones, you see that these guys have a very rough life, and they're incredibly tough. Smith once spotted an alpha female whose leg was dangling. She was attentively watching her pack hunt. Instead of hiding and nursing her broken leg, she was right there, alert to what was going on. She healed and survived. No, declares Doug Smith, wolves never feel sorry for themselves. It's never poor me. They're always forward. Their question is always, what's next? Now that's the passage from Safina, and that's what I love about wolves. They receive every moment of life as Sophia's most devoted practitioners of love wisdom. They have a joyful perseverance. They never give up, and they approach every situation as workable. That's the attitude of a real Buddha, a real bodhisattva, saint, sage, or priestess. Now, the mention of teeth in that passage might remind you of Wolf 8, because remember, he had lost some teeth too. But here's the thing about Wolf 8. He had bigger problems than just missing canines. Rick McIntyre writes about looking at Wolf 8's skull after he died, and here's what he writes. Not only were three canines broken, but several other teeth were missing or broken, and there were a lot of abscesses, meaning infections, in his jaws. Carnivore ecologist Jim Halfpenny said that there would have been a bad smell from those areas. Wolf 8 would have learned how to detect the scent of sickness and infection in prey animals and would know that he was now giving off that scent himself. Jim loaned me two photos of 8's skull, and I saw that his jawbones were honeycombed with gaping holes from those infections. The front of his lower jaw looked more like a sponge than bone. The pain he must have endured from those abscesses would be unimaginable. So that's what McIntyre found out after he saw what he saw. And that means that Wolf 8 went all out, even though he knew he smelled like a weakened animal, and even though biting on anything would have been painful. He never stopped to pity himself. That's a sacred attitude and a sacred embodiment. The sacredness of the wolf goes together with the life of the mountain. The life of the mountain is their life. From the hot summers to winters at 40 degrees below zero or worse, the humans watching the wolves would have layers of high-tech fabrics on and still find themselves shivering while the wolves faced each moment with clarity. As we noted, once our expansiveness gets broad and deep enough, we arrive not only at clarity, but also real fearlessness, because we verify that we have nothing to fear. We truly, truly have nothing to fear. The wolf touches that fearlessness more than most humans. And so, most humans feel fear at the sight of a wolf. Let's think about that cage and those wolves in that cage for a moment. Many of us sense that we live in a cage, that the dominant culture functions in many ways like a cage. Sure, seems comfortable in a lot of ways. But many of us are too worried about our teeth to do much about it. We live in the Matrix. That movie grabs hold of us because of how it resonates. And it's an old story. It goes 2,500-year-old story. Plato told the same story. And there was a reason for that. Recently, I heard the Nobel Prize-winning economist Angus Deaton talking about our situation right now. He said something pretty funny. I'm quoting here. He said, the drug companies were paying off politicians to turn the other way when their constituents were dying in droves. There's a sense in which the working class as a whole has become a flock of sheep to be sheared by corporate America. End quote. That's a Nobel Prize-winning economist. But it's not really shocking. And it has always been true in society structured by conquest consciousness. We considered some of this in various other episodes, like the episode called The Magnificent Swindle. That's a fun one. Or episodes on the dangerous wisdom of Adam Smith and the dangerous ignorance of Adam Smith. And also the episode called The Deepest, Darkest, Dirtiest Secret of Our Stress, Strain, Trauma, Anxiety, Depression, Imposter Syndrome, Burnout, and Loneliness. That's a mouthful. But the secret is out in the open if we have the courage to look. Maybe you could say it's behind, right? You know, when Rollins was talking about the shadow, the wolf's light shines. And if we look, we find the edges of our cage. And we can cut through all this nonsense and break free from our cages if we let the dignity and fierceness of the wolf inspire us. Think about the image Deaton gives us. We're a flock of sheep. It's actually worse than being sheared, you know? It's not that nice. I think we're getting eaten alive. So will we continue to be sheep or will we become wolves? I love sheep, but I'd rather be a wolf. Like a lot of other people, I worry about my teeth sometimes. I think that's perfectly natural. But if we're a bunch of sheep, or if we're in a cage that we're not getting out of unless we're willing to at least risk our teeth, then we have some deep thinking to do about what we truly are and what we could let ourselves become if we just let a little more of the light of the wolf shine in our soul. Now, we haven't finished contemplating the way of the wolf, and the rest of this, I think, is going to be even better. So if there's anything in here that resonated with you, it's going to get even better. I really encourage you. I'm excited to finish this contemplation with you. And that won't be the end of the story. There's so much to learn from wolves. But I want to recommend, again, reading Rick McIntyre's books, reading Carl Safina's book, Beyond Words, and reading definitely Mark Rowland's book, The Philosopher and the Wolf. And we're going to look more at Rowland's book in our next contemplation. You're going to really enjoy it, I promise. And we're going to link it together with that passage from Leopold that I said we would get to, but I really think we need to take a break. We've come a long way. So we're going to go back to Aldo Leopold and Dogen and Gary Snyder and Mark Rowland's. And we're going to lay out a little bit more of the way of the wolf, the sacred way of the wolf. Now, until next time, if you have questions, stories to share, thoughts, reflections about any of the things that we touched on, please send them in through dangerouswisdom.org. Sometimes I can't do any more than send you an email acknowledgement, but sometimes I might be able to bring some of your questions, reflections, stories into a future contemplation. Until then, this is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, reminding you that your soul and the soul of the world, your soul and the soul of the wolf, they're not two things. Take good care of them.